Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Coming up, the government moved quickly to quash any speculation of closer ties with Europe earlier today. But could free movement for Britain's young people be coming back soon within the EU? We'll discuss.
We'll also continue our conversation from last week on women's safety, as Home Secretary Yvette Cooper vowed to add extreme misogyny under the UK's extremism legislation.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme.
But first, here's the Week Unwrapped.
How many more children have got on our streets, Prime Minister? How many more children? How many more children, Prime Minister? Are we going to do something? What
are you going to stand up for our children?
That. Bye-bye.
Well, that was Keir Starmer being heckled after leaving flowers at a memorial for the Southport stabbing victims late last month. Well, the Prime Minister's honeymoon period appears to be over. According to a new poll by Ipsos, more than half of people think Britain is moving in the wrong direction. Of those polled, 22% said they think things in Britain are heading in the right direction, and 52% said in the wrong direction, and 19% said neither. Sir Keir does remain the most popular politician with polling data attached to them, with 38% having a favourable opinion towards the Prime Minister and 38% unfavourable. Ali, is this to be expected, do you think, after a couple of tough weeks in government?
Yeah, I think every Prime Minister has, once their honeymoon period is over, a pretty sharp decline in popularity. Cameron had it, Boris had it, everyone pretty much has it. The problem with that Keir Starmer has is he started at a lower base than they did coming in terms of popularity. I wouldn't pay too much attention at this present moment in time on the data of is the country headed in the right direction or the wrong direction, because no matter who the Prime Minister is or who the government is, you can't have changed the direction, the course of travel within a month and a half. And so I think there's still a bit of sort of kickback from the unpopularity of the Conservative government, because most people aren't as partisan as commentators and media folk. So I think generally the feeling is that things are getting tougher for everybody. That being said, I think the riots have really completely destroyed any honeymoon period that Keir could have enjoyed in government. Usually the first few months you enjoy a high, you can get some of the more difficult legislation through because you've got the bounce of having just won a majority first time in 14 years. Obama certainly had that, if we use that example of the first few months where he could sort of railroad legislation through because of the popularity and the hope that came with a change in government. That's pretty much been wiped out because of the riots.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I mean, I don't know how I would answer a question of is Britain moving in the wrong direction and say I think it's moving in the right direction after looking at what happened over the past 2 weeks. I mean, yeah. People literally smashing up their communities. Yeah. And, you know,
I think more people are likely to say we don't know what direction the UK is headed in rather than right or wrong.
I think there's been some pushback, and it's kind of been a very unlucky series of events, which is that the first issue Keir Starmer had to deal with was prisons overcrowding. Mm-hmm. They were really at crisis point. Some of them were at 100% capacity. So he had to release prisoners on early release.
Yeah.
And then he had to respond to mass riots by banging people up very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So that kind of was always going to create a real political problem, which is that people would be asked, how can you now find prison space for these people? And nobody likes the idea of criminals being released.
Interestingly
early.
Enough, by the way, the polling suggests that people thought he actually dealt with the riots fairly well.
Mm.
Obviously, the country is massively divided on them, but the majority or the biggest response was that it had been dealt with well or fairly well. Compared to that, to not. But it is a very tough set of circumstances, I think. But it highlights, for me, forget about Keir and Labour, I think the country is deeply divided.
Mm.
I think our society is deeply divided on generational grounds, on gender, on faith, on ethnicity. This is probably the most divided the country's been in generations.
And there's a real overrepresentation, I think, of pretty extreme right-wing voices in the UK media. I mean, we already know we have a predominantly right-wing press, but there are also niche right-wing commentators who are getting more and more popular, more and more vocal. And that we've spoken about this a lot on Politics Uncensored, about how that normalization of anti-migrant rhetoric has become really, really widespread. And I think just hearing people talk like that, you would come away thinking this is a very divided nation. You know, you would come away thinking things aren't getting better. And actually, you know, there's a lot of doom sayers, I think, at the minute.
Yeah, and I think the dangerous part of when the left is in power in this country, and I use the term left very broadly with care, is that the right-wing commentators are much more inclined to shout the descend of law and order, the descend of security, all that kind of stuff. And that naturally has consequences and makes... furthers the divide in our society. And I think that there is a desperate problem in our sort of media class, that it's so skewed in one ideological political side that you then get a complete disengagement from those who don't share those ideologies, who don't share that political view, and then they're pushed into the sort of depths of the sort of darker elements of social media and others. So then you end up with two camps, and it's what we constantly talk about.
Mm.
Becomes a football team. You wear red, I wear blue, and we just throw things at each other.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Really quickly, because we have to move on, but I want to ask you, what is one thing you think Keir Starmer can do really quickly that might start making the public feel that little bit brighter about the future?
Can I answer it in a more negative way?
Yeah, go on, yes.
I'll tell you what I'm worried about. Mm. I'm worried about the budget in October
and
increases in taxes.
Yeah.
Not because it's not the right thing to do. I do think it's the right thing to do. But we went around the country and we were so explicit that taxes would not go up that I think it poses a real risk of the right unanimously calling Keir a liar. And we know some on the left have that critique of him anyway. And I think it could cause some serious fractures. So that worries me a lot in terms of how is the increase in taxes. And look, I imagine it's going to be inevitable because of where public finances are. But how is that going to be communicated to the public?
Mm. It's going to be a tough autumn for the Stormtroopers. Okay, now from one side of the Atlantic to the other, it's the Democratic National Conference this week. And it's been a little bit different to what you might expect.
Georgia, how do you cast your vote?
Yeah! Ladies and gentlemen, we are here tonight to officially nominate Kamala Harris for president. 5 to 1, another round of shots. DHC, turn out for what?
Wow, I've got FOMO. That sounds amazing. If only party conferences had that level of entertainment back home. I don't think Labour party conference is going to be anything like that, especially after our conversation before, Ali. Now, it's been a boisterous few days at the Democrat National Conference, where the mood is overwhelmingly positive. Yesterday, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz accepted the Democratic Party's vice presidential nomination by emphasising his rural background as a teacher and sports coach in a more sweeping speech than the unassuming Midwesterner has given before. On Tuesday, Michelle and Barack Obama gave resounding endorsements of Kamala Harris, exhorting party members across the US to turn out and vote to defeat Donald Trump in November. Kamala now leads Donald Trump in most polling. Ali, what are you reading about the mood coming from DNC? I mean, obviously, that sounded amazing.
Yes.
But do you think that is, you know, an accurate representation of the feeling over there?
I do. First of all, I'm really jealous. I can only imagine what Labour Party conference stage will be like, rather than all that energy. Rule number 2.63 doesn't say that. It says this.
Can we just compare that to, do you remember Theresa May's Dancing Queen?
Oh, yes.
I mean, it's just, we just don't do it like the Americans. I'm sorry, we don't.
I'm going to complain about it every week. There's just, there's no Riz in our politics.
No, there's no Riz.
I think the energy is pretty bang on. Actually, I think it's organic, and I think that's what the key is. Normally, at American Party conferences, they try and manufacture some energy behind the candidates, and it usually works. You get about a 3-4 point bump in the polls. Both parties do. But I think what's happened with the Democratic Party was there was such a dread of a Joe Biden candidacy because of where he was being perceived in terms of his age. Now that he's been removed, it feels like a weight has been lifted off the party's shoulders, and they're now looking forward to the fight with Trump. So rather than them having this sort of, it felt like these training weights around their ankles and being told to sort of run after someone in the lead, which was Donald Trump, it feels like that's been lifted, and that energy was definitely felt on conference floor and in every speech. The other thing I would say is, I watched both Michelle and Barack Obama's speeches, and they are just a class above everybody else. And I particularly enjoyed Barack Obama's size references. So for anyone who's seen that, go have a look at that. It's hilarious. And you know that that will have gotten under Donald Trump's skin.
This is the thing. I feel like there's so much humor, and it's like the Democrat campaign has just been injected with youth. We know that Biden...
And it's reflected in the polling, by the way.
We know that Biden was dragging it down. Yeah. And he stood aside and Kamala's come in. And there was some worry about whether she would be able to reinvigorate that campaign. But it's like, I don't want to get too excited about this, but I'm starting to really feel like she could win. I mean, do you think it's too early to say?
No, I think definitely it's headed in the right direction. I was concerned about her candidacy because all the polling suggested that she would trail Trump similar to Biden, largely because in my experience, actually having campaigned against her is that she had this image of being a sort of Californian elite lawyer, and that was going to be difficult to connect. But I think because of who the opponent is, there is such a fear of sort of going back to Donald Trump, and now having a candidate who can actually make the arguments on stage without their age being a problem, she has shot up in the polls in a way that nobody could have expected. She's now leading in all the major swing states, which she wasn't doing 5 weeks ago. So there is definitely a lot of wind behind her campaign, and that is key. Actually, David Axelrod, who ran Obama's 2008 campaign, which is probably the best Western election campaign of my lifetime, in his book, he wrote something really interesting, which was the magic thing in campaigns is momentum. Mm. When the momentum is behind you, you usually win. And the momentum is certainly right now behind Kamala Harris. Mm.
It's really interesting. I saw a video on social media of Kamala in these various sessions, really giving it to various politicians, holding them to account. And the way she does it, you know, we know that there's been a lot of talk about lawyers and they're out of touch. But the way she does it, they've made it look cool. Yeah. They've made it look.
Yeah. The
really...
first debate will be key.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Next, we're going to talk about GCSE results. Obviously, today it's a big day. We've got big news. A-level results were discussed last week, and today is GCSE results day. Results for 16-year-olds have finally returned to pre-COVID levels. But there is still a worrying gap of attainment between private schools and the south of England compared to the rest of the country. Ali, are you worried that it took this long to get GCSE results back to where they were pre-pandemic?
Yeah, I think there has been a greater blowback in education than we have spoken about. Because when it comes to COVID, we constantly speak about the NHS and the waiting times, for example, and the fact that we're continuing to face the impacts of COVID within our healthcare system. But it was just as impactful, if not more so, in education for young people. And so I guess it's understandable, but really concerning that it's taken this long for them to go back to pre-COVID levels. That being said, there is still a divide in the equity of the or the equality of the results based on geographical location and economic background as well. I still have all the concerns I have with A-levels with GCSEs, but yeah, it's definitely at least somewhat reassuring to go back to pre-pandemic levels.
Mm. Yeah, I think there was a worry that the damage done by the pandemic could carry on for a generation, you know, and it feels like it's finally going back to the levels it was before. But you're completely right. I mean, this variation in results across England, students in London powering ahead of pre-pandemic grades, while top grades in Wales and Northern Ireland came down with a bump compared with last year. I mean, we have to talk about how we're going to level up the education system, I think. Mm-hmm. And I know Labour have obviously got this plan to tax private schools properly and their charitable status and put that money back in the state sector. But is that going to be enough?
Not on its own, but I think it's a good start. And I think it gives you an indication into the government hopefully understanding the challenges in terms of the different experiences and opportunities that are given to our young people based on private public schools, but also where they come from and their economic backgrounds. I think with GCSE level, at a younger level, things need to be looked at a little bit more holistically in terms of what's going on at the home, youth centres, all that kind of stuff has a serious impact, much more so than A-level grades do. So that's what I would urge for them to do. One of the things that I noticed as well, sorry, if I might ask you a question, is girls tend to do significantly better than boys. At 25.5% grade 7 and higher in England compared to 19.8% for boys. I thought that was really, really interesting.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I think, you know, levelling up the education system, it's not just about regional inequalities, but it's about gender, class, race, all those other things that have to be taken into account. Okie doke. Well, that is the week unwrapped. Coming up, could an agreement be reached between the EU and the UK for the free movement of young people? The government has moved to quash rumours of this earlier today, but should it happen?
FUPAR Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
What's kind of that one golden thing that you like to share with people who are trying to start a business?
That's a really easy one, because I have a mantra which, you know, I say to young people all the time, and they really get it when I say it. And it goes like, don't undermine who you are by comparing yourself with someone else. It's because we are all different. Why each of us is special.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yeah. The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
What the hell with Gabby Allen?
Three words to describe yourself.
Weird, funny, and quirky. I'm a strange guy.
Oh, I love that. That's good. Not many men would say that. Normally they're like, yeah, strong.
No, you know what? That's what people think I'm going to be. Like, they see, like, the gym and the muscles and the tattoos, and they think I'm going to be, like, this, like, serious, like, fuckboy, like, lad. You know what I mean? And then they meet me. And I'm like a Jim Carrey. I'm like a muscly Jim Carrey.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
What's going on in the DMs? Are you getting naughty pictures from fans? Girls, are you getting the odd little pic? I bet they're popping the DMs.
Yeah, the DMs are doing all right. I've got a lot of cousins, big family, so they're all touching base.
Yeah.
And there's a few girls in there as well. I've had some fruity videos come through.
Oh, so, tell us a little bit more.
You
no,
go, you go there.
Yeah, we're going there. Access all areas, mate.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. It's Ali Milani on Politics Uncensored with
Zoe Grunewald. Now, ministers have reiterated their opposition to any deal with Brussels allowing young people to live and work in EU countries, after reports said some elements of this could be agreed as part of a wider set of negotiations. The Times newspaper yesterday cited unnamed government sources as saying that UK ministers had accepted that they would have to give ground over parts of a proposed mutual youth mobility system if they were to get an agreement in other areas, such as reduction in checks on UK food entering the EU. But a government spokesperson has rebuffed this, saying, quote, "We are not considering it. There are no plans for this or any work being done on it," they said. Ali, this is really interesting to me for several reasons. The first being that this is a policy that people have been calling for to be relaxed for a long time since we left the EU. They feel it unfairly penalises young people. It puts us at a disadvantage compared to our European counterparts. But also, how quickly this was briefed out and then rebuffed. I mean, what? Let's just talk about the policy first. What do you think about free movement for young people?
Yeah, look, I think this is a really important policy, and it goes to the heart of what you said in terms of holding young people in our country back compared to European counterparts, because there is no question that there is enormous benefit to the economy, to productivity, and to the well-being and happiness of people who go work, volunteer, and live in other countries, experience other cultures, meet other people, are exposed to other ways of thinking and other systems, and then come home, come back to their home countries, and implement what they have learned and the broader understanding that they have of the world in our economy, in our productivity, in innovation, science, and STEM. Right now, we are at a massive disadvantage because our young people cannot do that. So again, it's funny for me when you have right-wing commentators who wrap themselves in the flag and talk about patriotism, yet they want our 18 to 30-year-olds to lag desperately behind French, German, Dutch, Belgian counterparts who get to enjoy that benefit, and their countries get to enjoy that benefit. So the policy granting 18 to 30-year-olds, I think, visas, it's up to 3 years to work, study, or volunteer in Europe and vice versa for European counterparts is of massive benefit and a no-brainer for me. But obviously, Farage is going to lose his damn mind.
I mean, I think this issue is quite clearly toxic, right? Because a lot of right-wing commentators warned that Labour would always take us back into the EU. Now, for some of us, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But, you know, that is a toxic issue. We know that the majority of the vote was to leave and we left. So,
but also, that's not what's happening here.
No.
I mean, I think it would be a mistake to allow them to frame it in that way. This is in no way rejoining the EU. If you think this is rejoining the EU, then I think you need further examination on other issues. This would be a treaty or a deal with the European Union to allow young people specifically early on in their careers and their lives to go out into Europe. You know, this is not a secret plot to take us back into the EU. In fact, if it was, government ministers wouldn't have rebuffed it so quickly. The other thing I would say is I think Keir and the Labour Party were very, very clear in the election that there was going to be closer ties with the European Union, and that was part of the foreign policy. And I think that that's all that this is.
I just find it really fascinating, as you've said before, that people, right-wing commentators, are so nervous. You know, they get so angsty about this idea of moving closer, working closer with the EU, as if we are some sort of superpower island that can do everything on our own. We can't. We have an aging population.
Yeah.
We have a health and care sector, a hospitality sector, a services sector that is hemorrhaging staff.
Mm-hmm.
We need foreign labour.
Yeah.
But not just that. You know, our universities are crumbling. We need foreign students to come as well.
Yeah.
This idea that we can make it on our own when we've got this declining birth rate, you know, we've got more and more people needing care, it just doesn't make any sense to me. Yeah. We know it doesn't add up. Yet any sense of Labour moving closer to actually striking a deal that's going to work with the country long term just absolutely promotes ire from these people.
Here's the truth. They hate the European Union. ideologically and in a weird obsessive way, it's the boogeyman. And therefore everything that the EU does is bad and everything against the EU is good. In fact, they hate it so much that they are willing to burn the NHS down, burn our universities to the ground, and burn any institution that does any good for people in this country in order to hit the European Union, in order to continuously attack the EU, and to continue this weird, obsessive, ideological fight with Europe that was started by Farage and his gang of weirdos. So I definitely think that people should, and generally opposition to far right sort of and the right wingers should not allow them to frame this in any way as an attempt to rejoin the European Union.
I'm interested because this has been briefed out from two Times journalists, they've from Brussels, right? So this to me screams as a Brussels as a briefing that's come from the EU. It was very quickly slapped down by the Labour government. What's happening here? Talk a bit, because you're a Labour insider. Tell us a bit about the politics here. Why would it be briefed out and why would it be rebuffed?
So there's a number of different things that could have happened here. And I'm using this based on my understanding of other policy areas. I haven't been involved in any of these discussions at all or been privy to any conversations around this particular policy. But a couple of things that generally happen. Often when you have a policy that you're considering that you believe might be unpopular, you'll brief it and then deny it and then watch the feedback across mainstream media, social media, polling on the ground. So what you'll do is you'll get somebody to brief that you're considering a policy area or a policy area is coming, deny it publicly, and then watch what feedback comes back to get a sense check of what people are thinking. That could be what's happened here. I don't think that that's what's happened here. What else could have happened here is that this is being briefed by European parties to kill it. In fact, what I think is most interesting is that the French in particular were adamant that the UK should not be allowed to, quote, cherry-pick EU post-Brexit access. And so it's possible that private conversations have happened with probably junior ministers in government who have been greenlit to start exploring this idea. And some of the hardline Europeans who may be saying, look, you're either in or out. And let's not forget, they want the UK economy in because it benefits Europe more broadly. That they have slapped back the UK by briefing this publicly, knowing what kind of response it's going to get from the far-right media.
It's all very House of Cards, isn't it? All this politicking, all this briefing and counter-briefing with all these kind of different motives.
What's funny as well is often with things like this, the more senior ministers will send junior ministers to do this negotiation. So if it's a controversial topic, they'll send a more junior minister to Europe to discuss the idea. And then if it gets a horrible backlash here at home, they'll sack the junior minister.
Cannon fodder.
Exactly. They'll sack the junior minister and go, that was never the plan. This person went rogue.
So, I mean, who would want to be an MP, let alone a minister? But OK, so do you think there might be an appetite in the Labour Party for some kind of reversal on our hard Brexit? Something that looks like a soft Brexit with a bit of freedom of movement? I mean, I don't see how they're going to solve any of the migration issues without some kind of returns agreement with the EU. Do you think, maybe not now, maybe not next year, but at some point Labour is going to opt for a softer Brexit?
Yeah, I think what Labour's struggling with right now is the realities of governance. When you're in a campaign, you can talk about smashing the gangs, which I think Keir very publicly spoke about, smashing the gangs that bring people to the UK. You can't do that without an agreement with the European Union and some working partnership with France and the European Union. So I think some of these things are tied to other policy areas that Labour are keen on. And we know for a fact that the Labour Party, its membership, its MPs, its councillors across the board are far more pro-EU, are far softer on Brexit. And thus, given they being the party in power now, that's likely to manifest itself. The only question is at the very top, people like Keir and those around them, how scared are they? And that fear might be justified or unjustified, depending on your point of view. But how scared are they of opening the lid back up in terms of a Brexit discussion in the country? Because we lose with that. Mm. When Brexit discussions happen, the progressive side, the left, the centre-left lose because the right have such an easy narrative to make. So the only question will be how fearful are the top of the Labour Party in opening that up again? Otherwise, some of the key policy priorities they have, they'll need closer ties with Europe.
So I always wonder about Sadiq Khan, who's the mayor of London, because mm-hmm. he is one of the most pro-EU,
he is.
Vocally pro-EU, high-profile Labour figures in the party. He's spoken about trying to get some kind of, you know, handmade deal for London and the EU of a freedom of movement. And he talks a lot about how immigrants and EU citizens have made London what it is, and he wants young people in London to have those opportunities. We also know that Labour is talking more about devolution. They're talking more about handing powers back to local communities. This might sound crazy, but do you see a scenario where certain parts of the country have more ties with Europe than other parts of the country?
Yeah, you're right. That has definitely been on the agenda, particularly for Sadiq, because London has been taking the brunt compared to other regions in terms of the impact of Brexit, because it has a far higher and more diverse population, more Europeans working here and living here, that alongside Scotland, for example, which didn't vote for it. So it's definitely true that that's something Sadiq has been asking for. I would be flabbergasted, like completely shocked, if we started to develop treaties and European agreement regionally as minutiae as cities across the UK, because I think that would open up a massive can of worms. But that being said, we know Keir Starmer is a believer in devolution. He said that himself very, very publicly. We know that some of the mayors and the regional leaders believe in this and would want this to happen. Usually, we say it in football, when all parties want something to happen, it usually happens. But I would be very, very shocked if we get that level of devolution and that policy like that around the country, because I think it opens up cans of worms in other policy areas. But it's definitely something that's being fought for. For example, when we talk about earlier, when we were speaking about whether with Labour in power, we're likely to see closer cooperations and a softer Brexit. One of the key people making that argument, obviously, Sadiq Khan.
It's really interesting. Do you think us discussing this, I mean, I'm sure, you know, Nigel Farage isn't listening, although he might be. The conversations about this appearing in the Times, is that all just kind of playing into Reform's hands? I mean, Starmer's already dealing with this threat from the far right. We know that this has amplified the voices of right-wing politicians like Nigel Farage. We know there's a Tory leadership contest going on where there's a battle for the soul of the party. Conversations like this, they're not good for Starmer in that sense. They play into Reform's agenda, don't they?
Definitely benefit. Any conversation around Brexit benefits Reform and Farage, because it's the terrain that they're most comfortable in. In fact, I actually think that although he will fake outrage over the coming days over this, I think this is the best thing for Nigel Farage and Reform. The more that they speak in terrain that they're comfortable with, immigration and Brexit, for example,
democracy.
The more comfortable they are, because they don't want to talk about the NHS. They don't want to talk about the fact that Nigel Farage has very publicly for decades been pro-privatization of the NHS. They don't want to talk about education, where Nigel Farage doesn't know what he wants to do in terms of education. They don't have policy areas in some of the critical parts of what it takes to run a country. They believe in a couple of things very, very passionately. And so the more that the terrain in terms of our politics is in their safer spaces, the more it benefits Reform. And I think that is what will worry Starmer and those around Starmer, is that you do not want the public discourse and the public conversation to constantly be in areas that Farage is comfortable in. And so far in a Labour government, it's been far-right riots, it's been immigration, it's now going to be, over the next couple of days, it's going to be our relationship with Europe. These are all topic areas that Farage and Tice and the others, who I don't remember their names, that's how relevant they are, it's all areas that they want to be comfortable in. If you want to defeat them, you have to push them to discuss things like education and healthcare, where we know what they believe in is desperately unpopular, even with right-wing voters.
I mean, I think we can overstate the influence, can't we, of the far right. I mean, when you go on Twitter, it feels like everybody on there is incredibly right-wing. But, you know, the polling has suggested that the move to allow young Europeans to come and work in the UK for a time is popular with the public.
When we're talking about overstating, you're absolutely right, but they're overrepresented in media and political spaces.
Of course. So a survey this week by More in Common found 58% of voters would back a scheme. So a scheme to see young Europeans come to work in the UK for a period of time. and only 10% were opposed.
Yeah. Well, look, most people, okay.
So why is Starmer not just going for it? Like, because the public mandate's there.
Because it requires courage, right? And look, I'm not Prime Minister. I have never been in the office of Prime Minister, so I understand caution, right? Because I don't have that responsibility. I'm not sat in number 10. So it's easy for me from the outside to say, courage, have the courage to fight these things, like I did 2 weeks ago on immigration when it came to the far right. But I still think it needs to be done. I think there's a fear of, look at what happened when Brexit was the main conversation to the Labour Party. But I think you're right. The reality is we overstate the popularity of the far right amongst the general population because it's so overstated in the media. The reality is, even, you know, most people, I came straight from the hospital today because I had an appointment about my leg, and we're sat there and there's massive overcrowding and clearly there's too many people on the appointment list for two doctors to see. I'm not sure if I asked every single patient in there whether we increase the capacity by 100% and have two extra doctors, whether they'd care where they came from. They just want to be seen. Right. And that's the terms in which we have to have that conversation with people. And in that sense, I don't think anyone would disagree. So I just think we have to have the courage and Labour has to have the courage to make that argument.
OK, coming up, we're going to continue the conversation we began last week on women's safety as Home Secretary Yvette Cooper promised to add extreme misogyny under Britain's extremism legislation. We'll discuss that and more with a women's safety campaigner next.
FUBAR Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
What's kind of that one golden thing that you like to share with people who are trying to start a business?
That's a really easy one because I have a mantra which, you know, I say to young people all the time and they really get it when I say it. And it goes like, don't undermine who you are by comparing yourself with someone else. It's because we are all different. Why each of us is special.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
What the hell with Gabby Allen?
Three words to describe yourself.
Weird, funny, and quirky. I'm a strange guy.
Oh, I love that. That's good. Not many men would say that. Normally they're like, yeah, strong.
No, you know what? That's what people think I'm going to be. Like, they see, like, the gym and the muscles and the tattoos, and they think I'm going to be, like, this, like, serious, like, fuckboy, like, lad. You know what I mean? And then they meet me. And I'm like a Jim Carrey. I'm like a muscly Jim Carrey.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
What's going on in the DMs? Are you getting naughty pictures from fans? Girls, are you getting the odd little pic? I bet they're popping the DMs.
Yeah, the DMs are doing all right. I've got a lot of cousins, big family, so they're all touching base.
Yeah.
There's a few girls in there as well. I've had some fruity videos come through.
Oh, so, tell us a little bit PG. More.
You want to go there?
Yeah, we're going there. Access All Areas, mate.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Malani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, continuing our discussion from last week, extreme misogyny will be treated as a form of extremism under new government plans, the Home Office has now said. Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, has ordered a review of the UK's counter-extremism strategy to determine how best to tackle threats posed by harmful ideologies. The analysis will look at hatred of women as one of the biggest ideological trends that the government says is gaining traction. Ms. Cooper says there's been a rise in extremism, both online and on our streets, that frays the very fabric of our communities and our democracy. Well, joining us to discuss this is Jamie Klingler, co-founder of Reclaim the Streets movement and a campaigner for women's safety and police reform. Thank you so much for joining us, Jamie. Tell us, what do you make of the government's proposal to include extreme misogyny under extremism legislation?
I think it's long overdue and we're really, really happy to see action happen. The Monday after the Sarah Everard vigil, Boris Johnson said that he was going to make misogyny a hate crime, and then 6 months later dialed it back and said it would overwhelm policing. And that's the thing, like our lives and our safety are never paramount and it's never at the front of the queue. So we've been promised lots and lots of things, but we've seen very little action actually take place in terms of demonstrably making our lives any safer.
Jamie, thank you so much for joining us. Some of Labour so far have talked about reviews also happening, and there's been a little bit of criticism that those reviews may not see tangible action. What are some of the key tangible actions that you would like to see the Labour Party actually do?
I think there's all kinds of reform that needs to happen around whistleblowing, around education, and really about the way we discuss and prioritize violence against women. Today, a new report came out that said there's all kinds of times that instead of going and seeing rape victims, police go to football games or they go to other places where they can see more clear and present danger, but not the long-term suffering that women do at the hands of men that plan to hurt them and continue to hurt them.
Jamie, I find this really interesting, particularly kind of classifying misogyny as extremism. I mean, what do you think has kind of taken the government so long to see misogyny as extremism? Do you think do you think it's because it's so ingrained in our culture, it's really hard to kind of pick out what is misogyny and what isn't? Or do you think it's something more kind of sinister about why it hasn't really been given the attention it deserves?
I think we're seen as collateral damage. Mm. Like women being hurt or women being called different names or that being a mitigating circumstance in the violence against us is not what people go into policing for. It's not guns, it's not gangs, it's not real crime. And so because it's uncomfortable, because the situations are uncomfortable, the training, the taking those reports, they just have not made it the main priority. And if they did, they will have tons and tons of cases to do because it happens so often and it's so much a part of every woman you know has experienced some kind of sexual harassment in public, on the tube, at school, and in hospitals. And so I don't think it's been recognized how pervasive it is and how it's the fabric of women's experience.
And it's not just an experience that's out on the streets. We know based on reports that have been done that there's institutional misogyny in the Metropolitan Police, for example. And so you imagine that there's going to be pushback because it's not something that they're just going to have to deal with in society, but within their own ranks.
Well, like how many more reviews do we have brilliant women like Angelini or Casey go in and show them what's wrong? Operation Soteria was done by amazing women who have shown the route map to more convictions, has shown how they need to talk to victims. And now they're saying they don't have enough resources or training to actually enact all of it. And that's what we need. Labor is upping the priority of women's safety and experience.
Jamie, I just sort of anecdotally, when I talk to my female friends who are dating, and when I talk to, you know, young women who are at school or they're online, it feels like there's been a real sort of resurgence of quite misogynistic language being used by young men. And I know we talk a lot about misogynistic influencers, for example, Andrew Tate. What do you think is going on here? It does really feel like sort of casual misogyny is on the rise again. Or perhaps I'm wrong. Perhaps it never stopped being an issue.
I think the polarization has really been exacerbated. I think the idea that the entitlement of women's answers, women, men letting them have their shot, and the fault and the blame of the myths of false reporting. And so all of this really, really denigrates women's experience, and it makes none of us report. If we really look at the actual facts of how many false rape claims are made, it doesn't stand up. But the amount of attention those get, the amount of attention that Andrew Tate gets, the way we're spoken to, and the amount of pictures that are sent. And when I was doing some of this work, a fake OnlyFans was made of me and sent to my father. And I did a documentary with Emily Attic, and we were walking around and talking about what it would take for us to take an intimate picture and send it to a stranger online. And we laughed for like 20 minutes because it's not even a consideration. Mm-hmm. It would never just happen. Yet every time I'm on television, I get like 15 pics of male genitalia. And we're used to it. We expect our daughters to get those types of pictures at school. We expect this to happen now. And we've let it go so far that it's the norm. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that we've got to take back. And we've got to work on communication and consent and what consent looks like, and not the dehumanization and the way that we treat growing up and becoming sexual. And everyone benefits if we're safe. It's a horrible way to go on a date if you're telling your friends where you are in case you don't make it home. Like, that is not a way to open into good relationships and good discussions and good sex. We all benefit if we're all more respectful and we actually treat each other just with some more decency.
Yeah, and I wonder how much, you know, we're speaking today particularly about the counter-extremism bills and the criminal justice element of this conversation, but what it seems to me like the more we talk about this topic, or particularly of violence against women and girls, is how holistic the approach needs to be. I'm looking at research in front of me that shows that there's an ideological gap that is continuing to grow between men and women in the way that we see the world. How much of this how much intervention is needed in spaces like education for young men at an early stage, for example, outside of criminal justice and the judicial system, to actually deal with some of the root causes of this incel culture and this violence against women and girls?
I think it needs to be a public health campaign. Mm. You know, like, we didn't used to wear seatbelts, and now we all wear seatbelts. It's that kind of root and branch, how we talk about it, how we talk about relationships, how we use curriculum, how we do empathy week, and how we really change how we think and look at the different gender roles and just the amount of respect. One of the things, when you take your highway code test, there is a thing like, if you're on a zebra crossing and an old person comes and they're taking forever, what do? And it's to wait. We need it to be, you can't beep at women. You can't yell things out of your cars. And I don't think that there's been a lot of big changes that we see systematically from the government, but we have changed the root of conversations with our partners, with our brothers, with our dads about our experiences. And I think we used to have those conversations 2 a.m. when we were drunk, talking about all the times we'd been flashed and all the times we were in a situation where we did more than we wanted to just to get out of the situation. And I think some of the shame of women's experiences has been alleviated by sharing with everyone and not just taking it home and swallowing it and not standing up for yourself. So I think we are learning in terms of the communal effort. And like, when I talk to my friends' daughters who are teenagers, they take a lot less blame of, oh my God, I let myself get in this situation, than I did growing up.
Jamie, I'm going to ask you final question, and not got that much time, so I'll try and be brief. It feels increasingly like there has been a sort of backlash to the Me Too movement. So, as you said, it allowed women to talk more freely about what's happening to them. But at the same time, you've almost got this extreme misogyny on the resurgence since then. How do we negate that? How do we stop that sort of back and forth, one step forward, two steps back? Is it all education, or is there something more you think we can be doing so that men don't feel like this is an attack and they need to reclaim some of the conversation?
I think a lot of it is education, because I don't think we treat it like it's a big deal. Mm. So we don't do the minor aggressions, and then it's like, oh, you're just overreacting. That wasn't that. Somebody's got to be able to hit on you, or there's no dating. I think we, like Me Too, if we're really honest, got companies to do much better NDAs. It didn't stop the behavior from happening. And that's the thing, is I can't stop male perpetrated violence against women. Men need to stop it. They need to take it out themselves. They need to look at themselves and adjust how they treat the people in their lives, because it's got to get better. Because if we go down the road more with incels and Andrew Tate, we're just you lose all hope, and it's really disheartening. Mm.
Thank you so much. That was Jamie Klingler. Jamie, thank you for all the work you do. Co-founder of hashtag Reclaim These Streets movement and a campaigner for women's safety and police reform.
Politics Uncensored on FUBAR Radio.
Ali, we heard there from Jamie Klingler, co-founder of the hashtag Reclaim These Streets movement. What did you make of what she said?
I think it was really interesting for her to speak about Winnie the public health campaign, because we've spoken about this issue quite a lot on the show. And to me, there is really an importance on a holistic approach to all of this, because I don't think we're going to solve this in the criminal justice system. I just don't think that that's where the solution lies. That doesn't mean much more doesn't need to be done, because it does. The conviction rates are embarrassingly and horrifically low, and that sort of work needs to be done. It needs to be taken seriously. It needs to actually be rooted out of policing itself. But generally, I think there's a cultural issue. I mean, the data that I'm looking at in terms of the ideological gap opening between young and women and men is hugely concerning. And I liken some of it to some of the conversations around race, because there was an enormous backlash from some sections of our communities over conversations around racism and institutional racism in different industries. And the reality is, I think we have to be honest, that when some people recognize that they're losing privilege, they fight back. And I think some of it is like that with men. I think some men, like Andrew Tate and others, realize that the way our society and our culture is going is losing some of your privilege. And that's the fight back that we're seeing. The only way to fix that, I think, is to have, I think Jamie was right, a public health campaign, an educational campaign that deals with this at a much younger level.
It's really interesting. I mean, Sadiq Khan did a campaign, didn't he, which was, I think it was called, like, Say Mate to Your Mate. And it was like, men need to call out sexual harassment. And I actually thought it was a pretty good video campaign. But at the same time, it was quite widely mocked.
Yeah.
And I wonder what's behind that. It's like, you know, when you show these examples of men sexually harassing women, a lot of men think, well, my friends would never do that, or I'd never do that. And for a lot of men, that is probably true. But there are lower levels of these things going on. You know, like the locker room talk that does happen.
It does.
And, you know, you might have a friend who you just know he's a bit handsy with women. And, you know, you might tell him. But do you tell him enough? Do you, you know, there's lots of these conversations, I think, that can be happening. And it's very, very nuanced and it's difficult. But I think part of the problem is men feel, you know, the men who genuinely feel like they're trying to do their best feel almost kind of picked on by that. And I think we need to restore that narrative where it's, you know, it's not about being picked on. It's about standing up for women.
Yeah. And I, you know, one of the problems I think is identity politics. I think often people on the progressive end and the left wing end of the political and ideological spectrum say that it doesn't exist. It does. And I think what it does is similar to when we talked about partisanship earlier, it puts people into teams. And now I think there's this feeling that men think that there's a fight against women and that we're all kind of retreating into our identities and we're on different teams. And I think that's really, really harmful and dangerous. Ultimately, again, like I think a more holistic approach is necessary and to discuss some of the impacts. I'll end with this. This is the last thing I'll say, because it really changed the way that I look at the world. And I told you this off air a couple of times. Most of us, the ideologies that we have are based on our lived experiences. So our childhoods and the interactions we have with other people and stimuluses around the world determine how we look at the world. I didn't realize how dangerous London and the world is for young women, or women of all ages, at night, on the train, all this kind of stuff. I was completely oblivious to it until I was educated by my colleagues like you, my wife, my friends, other things. And what I think needs to happen for men to understand how big of a problem this is to open up their world outside of their individual lived experience. They need to hear from women how intimidating it is on the train and in their day-to-day lives. And I think that's really, really important. Well, that's it. I think it's been a really heavy end of the show, but we've spoken a lot about this, and I hope that it's something folks can take away, and we'll continue to talk about it. But that's it this week from Politics Uncensored. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani UK.
And you can find me at Zoe underscore Grunewald.
If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at foobarradio.com. Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.